Les colloques du Collège de France.
So the last speaker before the second coffee break is Anna Pombo, and Anna comes from the Max Delbruck Center for Molecular Medicine in Berlin, Germany, and Anna is going to tell us about variation in 3D genome structure between cell type and in stimulus.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Danny, for organizing this event and bringing us all together. I think it's been really wonderful. My lab, as we get through the day, it becomes less, more nonsensical to do an introduction, but I will tell you what our motivation is. And so in, or my motivation is, and so in as you know and seen, there's gene regulation across all scales. And we can think about the structure of the genome itself as a layer of intrinsic information, which has the potential to enable or restrict what each cell can do. Also, what transitions can happen, and in the case of, in particular, cells that don't divide, how cells respond to the environment, to whatever they need to do, and go back to steady, to, you know, they're able to fluctuate between states as the animal or the organism lives. And we can think about mechanisms at the local level, single point mutations. We have examples of this. We have the more complex organization. We tend to hear a lot about pairwise contacts, but actually there's complex interactions and they up to now fairly understudied. And this, we then have higher order conformations, which we've heard about, the TATs, also compartments. And all this organization ends up also at different levels at how different parts of the genome, for example, associate with the lamina or with particular other compartments within the nucleus. And one important thing that at least I try to keep in mind is that there's not one mechanism. Each gene is going to be maybe sensitive to different of these elements. And so maybe some genes are regulated locally, others may be very importantly regulated by enhancers. Others may or not be sensitive to whether they are at the periphery. And even we could think that some genes may be regulated by some of these mechanisms in some cell types or states and then be regulated by other mechanisms. So it means, at least, as I think we've heard also, there's a lot of cell type specificity in how structure and gene regulation interact. And so we're interested also in this heterogeneity of mechanisms across the scales of genome organization, as well as in cellular conditions. And one other motivation to think about 3D genome structure as a means to discover disease mechanisms is that we have many complex and rare diseases that are often polygenic, not always familiar. You may have a few patients, so are we going to discover perhaps the mechanisms of a non-coding mutation? The genetic variation mutations very often are in the middle of nowhere, and so what are the genes or the pathways that are affected? And one example I like to show is schizophrenia, where in this particular study there were about 100 variants discovered, and I think only 3 out of 100 were in coding regions. So how do we discover what all these variants are doing? And you can see they're essentially almost across all chromosomes. And finally, also there's aspects of environmental. So if we're exposed to drugs, our lifestyle, as we get old, how does 3D genome structure impact on gene expression? And so one other element that we I think all should try to keep in mind, and it has come through the meeting as well, is that essentially there's a lot of also chromatin structure variation even within the cell population. There's a probabilistic aspect of chromatin structure, but also the outputs. And so we need to think of probabilities, not of boxes and places and one structure, and how different probabilities relate with each other. And so here is just one example. Where if you see this is if you see the average map, we see the typical triangles we've already heard about, but as we can look also in single cells, you can see that domains exist at the single cell level, but they seem to occupy different positions, and when you average them all up, you then get what you might see in an IC method that comes from a large number of cells. In this particular paper, when they depleted cohesin, they found indeed that the domains were lost, but at the single cell level, this was not the case. There were still many domains, or there were still domains. And what is conclusion from this was that essentially, by losing cohesin, we didn't really lose the ability or the formation of domains. We lost their preferential probabilistic position for that particular cell type. And so with these few elements of motivation, we essentially think about 3D genome as a probabilistic phenomenon, which also gene expression and transcription factor binding, etc., is. And we want to see if we can discover and quantify what are the most important, most non-random structures, contacts, and other topologies, ideally and biasly, and also across all genomic length scales. Ideally, we want to do this with single-cell information. We want to be able to do it directly in tissue so we can study real cells in the real context if they're already thermally differentiated, so we can study homeostasis. And we want also to preserve the structure we're studying, so we want to not perturb the structure of chromatin before we map it or minimize that. And if possible, eventually, to be able to do this with single-cell resolution while having orthogonal data from the same cell, such as RNA expression of protein levels, or and also includes tissue spatial information. And so as you all know, I think most of you know, maybe not all of you, my lab developed a technology called genome architecture mapping, which is orthogonal to other methods to map genome architecture, in particular IC. And this method is based on taking a collection of cells and from each cell sampling the nucleus with one slice, cut from random orientations. And one way to see this, the motivation for this is that we want essentially to get an understanding of what, across all positions in the genome, which ones are more often together in a non-random way. And so if you have A and C that are very close together in physical space, they're very far away in the linear space, what happens is if we challenge this object, the nucleus, with a sampling process, which is a slice, you will see that very often when we, in any slices we have A, we're going to have C. Very rarely we're going to have A and B because they're very distant in physical space. And if we do this a few hundred times, we then are able to see which parts of the genome are more non-randomly together in a fully unbiased manner without us choosing the locus we want to study for a particular biological problem. And so the GAM data is essentially this. You slice some nuclei, you extract the DNA sequence and detect it, and then you have a table for each nuclear slice, which parts of the genome are in or out. You can use any resolution you like, as long as you have enough data in the data set. And from the GAM data, which, as I say, is this table of pluses and minuses, we can then extract lots of different structural components. One of them, and this is only one of them, is, of course, the pairwise contact matrices, which are essentially how often does any two pairs in the genome co-appear in the collection of slices divided by or normalized by how much you detect each of them. Now, from this, because it's a physical method, a method that senses physics, space, volume, area, distance, we can also extract, for example, compaction, and also, if you have enough cells, also radial position. Now, how does this work in the lab? So GAM is a method that combines technology from electron microscopy and imaging with genomics. So it's maybe a bit exotic method because of the two extremes of there's not many people who can do electron microscopy and do a library. I'm sure if in the audience you have experience in either, you don't find either especially difficult. So you can actually learn both. And of course, in my lab, and many guests we've had so far learned both. And so you start with a piece of tissue, and importantly, this tissue or pellet of cells, it's fixed as if you were going to do electron microscopy, which means we want to preserve the structure of the cell as well as we can. Importantly also, we keep other molecules in these slices, the RNA, the proteins, which in orthogonal, in multimodal versions of GAM, means we can have single-cell information. After this, we cut a thin slice. So this is electron microscopy technology. We then use laser microdissection. This is an innovation to cut laser microdissection of such as tiny materials. And then in each of our PCR plate wells, we're going to have a single nucleus slices. In some versions, we can have a couple or two or three. That still works. The statistics still works. And then we need to extract the DNA. This is really tiny, tiny amounts, so the equivalent to a single chromosome. We then need to do the next generation sequencing, which of course we do multiplexed, and then we developed lots of the computational methods to detect signal over noise, as well as to treat this problem statistically with special statistics elements. And one way to see is really collect this data, and it's not going to work with this pointer now. Maybe I shouldn't have done it, and I don't know how to take it. Do I know how to? Yes. Let's see, is to watch us collect. So some of you have seen this, but it's useful for those who haven't. And so you'll see that in the first few dozens, it's still very empty, the matrix, but as you collect more, you'll see that after 100, 200, then the matrix is really stabilized. And of course, the more slices we collect and sequence, the better, the more precision we have in our statistical assessments. And so we like to collect more than 300, but it's also possible to detect differences with lower. It really depends how different are the two structures. So if they're very different, you don't need a lot of sampling to detect the differences. And so in the first GAM publication, this was applied in mouse embryonic stem cells by Rob Bigri. He already appeared his name in the slides of Mina. We found unbiasedly that in ES cells, the elements that come together more non-randomly are active genes and enhancers with enhancers, and active genes with active genes. Of course, heterochromatin is also coming together, but it doesn't seem to care exactly which other part of heterochromatin it chooses. And we found that this is true at two different scales. That's a scale of 30 kb, which is about the scale of a gene, as well as the scale of 1 megabase, which is the scale of TADs. And so we found that TADs, which contain clusters of enhancers, or called superenhancers, they really unexpectedly found together much more often than their abundance. And this is true for TADs containing superenhancers, as well as highly transcribed TADs or combinations thereof. By applying this method, we discover some very long-range contacts between superenhancers, which using FISH we were able to validate. And so we have examples of superenhancers, in this case 20 megabases apart, in mouse embryonic stem cells, cells that are dividing fairly fast. We could find from the unbiased GAM data what elements that we could then all validate by imaging. Now, since then, we have been interested in the problem of how specialized is 3D genome structure, especially because there's also literature highlighting extensive conservation of structures. This is all a bit of how what you, each of us perhaps is talking about. But we have several examples. One of them is even looking at the two copies of our chromosomes. This is data, that's a paper that's just been accepted in Molecular Systems Biology, where most of us write in most of our talks, not all, we were looking at, or are looking at, average of the structure of two chromosomes, but when we deconvolve the two, you actually see that there's extensive differences in the structure of the two copies. And of course, this is going to change a lot how we do research and understand 3D genome structure. And for this, the GAM technology is extremely powerful. And we can not only do this here in a mouse hybrid stem cell, which has a lot of SNPs, but we can also do it in human cells, where the density of SNPs is 10 times, 15 times lower. We've also looked in early development, and we found that immediately, not only using in vitro model ES cells and Xen cells, but even directly in the mouse embryo, that the structure of chromatin is immediately distinct, even at E4.5. And we've also have a larger program looking at neurons. And here we compared four different cell types, ES cells and three brain cells. And in this example, we looked at the position of TAD boundaries, and we found that most of them are actually distinct. Only 14% were conserved, and there were many TAD boundaries that were seen only in one cell type. I should say this is also true if you look at IC datasets from the lab of Capra here. And in the TAD borders specific of each cell type, we find genes that are also specific of that cell type. And so, for example, in pyramidal glutamatergic neurons of the hippocampus, important for memory formation, they're undergoing synaptic activation. We found cognition. For example, in the oligodendroglia, we find the receptor and membrane reorganization. Now, going back to the cell type variability, another aspect, which I think we also heard earlier from René, is the cell type specific impact of point mutations. In this case, we collaborated with Daniel Schramek from Toronto University in Canada, and they were interested in a SNP, very highly predictive of low-grade glioma. And they have they experimentally mutated, you know, the disease-associated SNP in mouse embryos, and they found that actually the SNP was active in all neuronal tissues. Nevertheless, the cancer was specific of the glia cells. And so we took advantage of GAM data, the GAM data that we had produced in different cell types, and we looked at the contacts of this particular SNP, which is 1.7 megabases from the MYC gene. And we found really that it's only in the oligodendroglia cells that the SNP is more strongly contacting the MYC gene. If you look only at the top, I think, 15% most stronger interactions, we could see that it was really only in the glia. Nevertheless, you can see that there are contacts still occurring in the other cell types, but essentially, again, back to the probability of how these contacts form, that they seem to be extremely important for what really the contacts are doing ultimately. Importantly, here we could also see that there's other regions that form the similar contacts, and they had been sort of overlooked by the clinical geneticists, but through analyzing this data, we then put more light into investigating further genetic variation within this tissue, which is currently ongoing. So, essentially, with this work, we show that brain cells have highly specific 3D topologies. Another example is if we look at the cluster of protocadherin genes, you can see that only the gamma is expressed in ES cells. The alpha and the beta are not expressed, and the locus is more traditionally organized in the domains. When we look now in the brain cells, we see that with the activation of the PCDH alpha and beta clusters, we now start having contacts that connect these active genes with each other. And this is true in all the brain cells. But interestingly, when we look at the oligodendroglia, where FGF1 is also expressed, we also see a very specific contact established only in that particular cell type. Now, here we're looking at individual animals. This is also one of the advantages of our technology. And if we, when we compared with the replicate, so hippocampi from different mice, again, we could reproduce the same structures. Now, bringing us now more to the topic of transcription factor and regulatory regions, we were interested to investigate how these differences in contacts relate with differences in the enhancer, or let's say the chromatin accessibility of these two cell types. For this, we took only the pyramidal glutamatergic neurons and dopaminergic neurons. So this one from the hippocampus, this one from the midbrain. We add the GAM data. This is sort of a mirror image, but hopefully you can see that there's many contacts here formed in the pyramidal glutamatergic neurons that are absent in the dopaminergic neurons. We then devised a pipeline, and maybe for the sake of time, maybe I just go directly here to say that essentially we subtract the two matrices, we get the differential contacts, and then for each set of differential contacts, we ask, overlay them with the attack peaks for the same cell type. And we then ask which types of transcription factors are found in each of these contacts. We focused only on differentially expressed TFs. And essentially the question was, if we take only the contacts that are differential and that are marked by differentially expressed TFs, what comes out with this? And so here we asked, so which TFs are most enriched in each of the neuron type-specific contacts, and also which genes, if any, are involved in the said contacts. Now, interestingly, we found, and this is a more advanced analysis, I don't always very often present it, essentially we found that there was a set of TFs that was highly specific of the differential contacts in each cell type. In the pyramidal glutamatergic neurons, these were overwhelmingly enriched by NeuroD transcription factors in combination with some other factors. So these are contacts here, and you can see that there's thousands of contacts that contain in the anchors these pairs of TFs, but not so often CTCF. So many differential contacts are really independent of CTCF. Pyramidal glutamatergic neurons are undergoing activation as the animal explores its environment. For the dopaminergic neurons, these are more quiet, at least in the in this naive situation. And here we could find CTCF was more important, as well as a different set of transcription factors, FOXA1 and NR4A1, which are important TFs also for the ends. So we decided to then collect all the contacts, all of these, and ask what genes might be involved there. And this is, I guess, what I mostly wanted to show you. So we were very surprised that by getting the differential contacts with the differential TFs, we could see actually discover half of all differentially expressed genes. So without using expression to, particularly look at those genes. And so by taking contacts and TFs, we found essentially most or many of the genes. And importantly, these genes were highly specific for the functions of these neurons. So in the glutamatergic neurons, we found glutamate receptor binding and synaptic plasticity, whereas in the dopaminergic neurons, we found adult behavior and response to drugs of addiction. And these neurons we're using are from the ventral tegmental area of the midbrain, and this is the neurons that first respond to an exposure to a drug of addiction. And this work really told us or connected genes that are really distant in the genome, which are forming these hubs across a long distances, informed by transcription factor binding sites. And so we have this model. So we have in pyramidal glutamatergic neurons synaptic plasticity genes forming hubs, which are not present in the dopaminergic neurons. And conversely, in the dopaminergic neurons, we have hubs of addiction pathway genes that are not present in the PGNs. And this then brings us to now our current work, where we're looking at the homeostatic memory of cell identity. So if we interfere with the function of PGNs or the function of DNs, what happens? And we have in hippocampus models of autism where we specifically delete genes related with autism spectrum conditions, such as SHANK3, genes involved in learning disability, such as CTCF, if you mutate them in the glutamatergic neurons, as well as sleep deprivation. And in the midbrain, we have a large program looking at addiction, single exposures to drugs of addiction, and investigating cellular memory. And in before the bell rings, just to go over a little bit of this work, this is in a bioarchive, you can also have a look at it. So we know from the literature that in the first 24 hours, there's a lot of known and well-described behavior, neurophysiology, neuroplasticity. These are all mostly resolved by 7 days, which means if I show you an animal which had cocaine 7 days before, you would not know. But nevertheless, we know these animals respond differently to a second exposure to cocaine, so there's some cellular memory. We also know from stronger activation of neurons induced by potassium chloride that, again, there's changes in transcription, even in 3D genome, but again, all resolved within one day. And so the question was, could a single exposure to cocaine alter 3D genome topology, in that manner alter the structure of the genome as a different substrate for the reinjection? And so we designed an experiment where we ignored all the changes that happened in the first 24 hours. We're now studying them, but this was in the first study. Decided to look at 24 hours only, and then 2 weeks later, no one has really, to our knowledge, done this. We collected gum in the dopaminergic neurons from the VTA, which is not the easiest experiment to do, as well as single nucleus RNA-seq. And for the sake of today, I'll just focus on the changes in topology. So we found here in the saline, you have a typical structure where we still see the TADs, but in GAM data, we also see many long-range contacts. Upon 24 hours, we can see essentially a massive distortion of the chromatin structure. And you ask what happens by 2 weeks, is it all back or not? And the answer was that not really. There's some areas of the genome that recover, but many still remain disorganized. And it can be events of decondensation, as you can observe here, but it can also be events of condensation. And it's essentially a system recovering from an insult that actually the system has not evolved to survive. Just to show you another example, this is RBFOX1, an important gene, alternative splicing factor. And you can see in the saline conditions, it's fairly condensed. It's not particularly highly expressed. Upon the activation, when we look 24 hours later, it's more decondensed. But it doesn't go back. It actually continues to decondense as time goes on, suggesting there's some kind of chaotic trial to recover that is not particularly successful in this gene and many others. Now, we collaborated with Mario Nicodemi to look at models, and what you can see in these examples is that really the structure is fairly, as we perhaps see in many systems, as we look in 24 hours or 2 weeks, it becomes much more disorganized, and we can actually look at the ensemble of polymers, like René looked, and get distances, so we can see that larger distance in blue, that as we recover, or time passes since the cocaine happened, the distance is getting larger and larger between particular points in this domain. But not only that, interestingly, also the standard deviation is becoming much larger, suggesting we now have a structure that's no longer well-structured. It's now more variable. And this happens in this cocaine system. It doesn't happen in other systems. Or we think it doesn't happen in other systems, such as sleep deprivation, which we evolved to survive. So in summary, upon a single exposure to a strong stimulus, such as cocaine, this is not something the animals have evolved to know what to do with. We have waves of cocaine-induced transcriptome changes. Most of them are resolved by 24 hours. Nevertheless, when you look at the variance of gene expression, it's highly variable. No gene actually passes the typical single-cell p-values that we all use. Need to use slightly more subtle ways to look at gene expression. But the variance certainly is very large at 24 hours and reduced at 2 weeks. We see extensive changes in genome structure at all levels. I just show you some of them. The disordered chromatin structures at 24 hours, sometimes they resolve, they get back to normal, but very often they stay disordered, but even worse, they get more distorted as time goes by, which of course this is not the ideal outcome. And I didn't have time to show you, but by projecting back to the single cell maps where we don't have a lot of power, the genes that we see with altered topologies, we can then discover DN subtypes where perhaps these genes are more affected. So there's really some extra power in combining the topology study with a single cell gene expression. And we also find that addiction SNPs are, even just after one exposure, they are already enriched in regions that are, especially the ones that are condensed after 24 hours and remain condensed 2 weeks later. And this is a summary. We found many important genes, also in this teal color. So these are genes already associated with cocaine chronic addiction. They were not known to be already altered upon a single exposure. We find many postsynaptic genes, transcription factors and ion transport, as well as genes important for localization and metabolism, and also RNA processing genes. And we find them through our different analyses of different TAD borders, chromatin condensing and decondensing, or regions of the genome that are very rich in differential contacts. I mentioned sleep deprivation. I leave you just with an image here, where we can again see that, as in blue, genes might be downregulated upon a sleep deprivation, a single sleep deprivation event. We find extensive changes in chromatin structure. In this case, as the gene gets repressed, it gets more condensed. We also find other genes that upon sleep deprivation, if they get more repressed, they become more open. So it's really not a trivial phenomenon, the being condensed or opening. There are cases for both, and I think this is also true in the enhancer analysis. And to finish, I thank my lab, in particular Warren, who initiated our work with the dopamine neurons. Also Isabella, Sasha, Dominic, Luna, working with the cocaine work, Dominica for the sleep deprivation, and Chris, computational biologist, really contributing also to all projects in the lab, our funders, and our collaborators. And I guess for today, I like the work of Lonnie, who works with us integrating contacts with transcription factors and searching for patterns of TF combinations. So thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.